It's Tuesday, December 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Coming up, the number of migrants and refugees entering Europe this year reaches 1 million. We'll hear from a migration expert about what's fueling the influx. We'll ask a security analyst about what's driving a Taliban militant offensive in Afghanistan. And International Edition's David Byrd previews the new movie Joy, starring Jennifer Lawrence. That's all ahead on International Edition. The International Organization for Migration says the number of migrants and refugees crossing into Europe by land and sea this year has passed 1 million. That's four times the number that entered Europe in 2014. In a report released Tuesday, the IOM, which is based in Geneva, said the vast majority of this year's migrants crossed into Europe by sea, with more than 800,000 traveling from Turkey to Greece. Most of them are refugees from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Well, earlier I spoke to an IOM press officer in Switzerland, Joel Millman, and I asked him how his organization was able to tally such a big number of migrants.
Well, mostly we're relying on the data from ministries and law enforcement units across the Mediterranean shoreline, Greece, Italy, Spain, Malta. Mostly we're in contact with those governments, and we get the data as soon as it comes in. We also have monitors at all the ports and the islands of Greece, not every island, but quite a lot, the big ones where migrants have been coming in this year, and also the ports in Italy where rescued migrants on the high seas are brought in for processing. So we're getting pretty reliable numbers from the agencies that are in charge of those rescues and the ones who are doing the registering in the various countries as well.
What are the main factors behind the influx of the migrants and refugees this year?
Well, the biggest is the change in the composition of refugees in the Middle East, principally Syria and Iraq. People that were staying in countries like Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, to some degree a tipping point was reached, and it just became much harder for people to remain there for a variety of reasons, and they began to follow the path. And we already had 40,000 Syrians last year came through Libya, so it was a pretty robust flow of Syrians going great distance to get to Tripoli and then get boats for Italy. That traffic largely shifted back to the Middle East, and you know, the people leaving Turkey. This year from Libya, we only had 7,000 Syrians. So we know that's moved back, and I'm sure that scale, 40,000 plus, just contributed to a much bigger number. It sort of snowballed up from that. And I don't have off the top of my head the total number for Syria, but it's something close to the 800,000 plus that have come through Greece this year.
Well, the IOM released a statement saying that a more coordinated European response is beginning to take shape. What does that response look like?
Well, we're not really 100% sure of how the new border patrol is going to work, some of these new law enforcement measures, but it's just this fact that so many countries are agreeing to consider different types of resettlement numbers. It may be a quota, it may not be a quota, but it's something that we're confident that our members, you know, all 28 members of the EU are also IOM members, are working towards a solution that will work for the continent.
Well, some European nations have been setting up barriers to the migrants and refugees in recent months, or saying that they want to otherwise restrict the numbers flowing in. So what is the IOM doing to address this backlash that we're seeing in Europe to the influx?
Well, I mean, much of it is just advising governments and member states. The 28 members of the European Union are also our members of IOM. We act to work on perception change. We're reaching out to the media, social media, all kinds of media, to make people understand that we consider a lot of these fears manufactured or stereotypical. There's all kinds of ways that you can disarm and refuse this kind of fear over migrants coming in. But mostly we're advising people that the greater difficulty it is crossing border, the more likely a migrant's going to turn to a criminal organization. And you're going to see the kind of tragedies that we saw this summer when 71 people were found dead in a refrigerated truck in Austria. You know, people who can't cross legally and safely risk very dangerous passage and often lead to death.
And how do you see this migrant wave continuing into next year?
Well, we don't see any immediate stop. I mean, the winters were always low traffic periods. That seems to be the case. I can only say that we didn't think last year's number would be repeated, and last year's number was quadrupled this year. It's hard to imagine even more migrants than this year coming next year, but we've been learned not to be surprised.
Well, thank you very much to the IOM spokesman, Joel Millman. Thank you very much for speaking to International Edition.
My pleasure.
Well, it's time for a look at social media and what they're saying about the big milestone in Europe's migration crisis. I've been looking at Twitter, and the big hashtag is hashtag migrant crisis. Here are a couple of tweets that I've found using that hashtag. One of them comes from Dagenham Man. He is at KTF1965. He says, "Are the do-gooders too blind to see that not everyone is what they seem, and the migrant crisis will affect existing low-income families in Europe?" Well, here's a tweet from hashtag Ghana. That user says, "The migrant issue seems to be an unending nuisance, but can the West really continue developing 100% without them?" Here's a tweet from a user named at Mostly Courtney. She says, "It's selfish to be complaining about not having the new iPhone or new Xbox game on Christmas when there are families without homes." And lastly, here is a tweet from user Ricardo Romani. He says, "Europe has just gained a country the size of Estonia." And Estonia's population is just over 1 million, and that is, of course, the number of migrants who have entered Europe. Well, if you'd like to reach us on Twitter, you can find us at VOA_IE. You can also tweet me at Michael_Lippin. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
"This is a problem that inflicts almost every country."
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
1 of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views, presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
Listening to International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Britain says it is deploying military advisors to Afghanistan's southern province of Helmand, where Western-backed Afghan forces engaged in fierce battles with Taliban militants on Tuesday. The British announcement comes one day after a Taliban suicide bomber killed 6 U.S. troops near a NATO base outside the capital, Kabul. And that was the deadliest attack on Americans in Afghanistan since August. Well, Christopher Sneddon is a South Asia analyst with the Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies. He told International Edition's Victor Beatty that Taliban militants are stepping up their efforts to capture Helmand province.
There's a very well-known Pakistani journalist called Ahmed Rashid who's written a lot about the Taliban in Afghanistan, who's now claiming that the Afghan regime is in total panic over the Taliban's current offensive and that it's not improbable that the Taliban may come back. And if they are to capture Helmand, then that would be part of that particular comeback, because that, again, is their heartland, and it will be very difficult for the Afghan forces to retake that. There's two other aspects associated with this as well. Civilian casualties this year are considerably higher than for a long period. In fact, probably the worst ever, according to some reports. And also, looking at the figures for the Afghan security forces, they're down by about 10 to 15,000. So there's some serious capability issues on the Afghan government side. They don't have air power. They have some access from foreign air power, but they don't have their own air power, and they also have some issues maintaining some of the capabilities that they've got. So they are under some significant pressure, it seems, at the moment.
The UN Security Council on Monday extended sanctions against the Taliban for 18 months, warning of increasing presence of affiliates of the Islamic State as well. Nicholas Haysom, the UN envoy for Afghanistan, said afterwards that the security situation is extremely challenging, with the most significant threat coming from the Taliban insurgency. He also said the government in Kabul needs to prove itself worthy of international support in the coming new year.
The government in Kabul does have some issues. The intelligence chief resigned a little while ago, partly over a disagreement with the president, Mr. Ghani. Mr. Ghani, I have seen one or two reports saying that he's not particularly well at the moment, which is an issue as well. They do seem to be under stress, there's no doubt about that. But in terms of ISIL, ISIS, Daesh, whatever you want to call this particular group, it seems that they're only at this stage in the Nangarhar area of eastern Afghanistan, and that's partly to do with controlling trade and various other things in that particular province. One of the aspects of the Taliban is that they don't want to acknowledge the caliph, because by doing so they would lose some degree of power or autonomy. They want to control Afghanistan on their own terms. So there's a bit of a power struggle, ideologically speaking anyway, between some of these Islamic elements.
Well, and that was Christopher Sneddon, and he is an analyst speaking to International Edition's Victor Beatty. Well, the race for the Republican U.S. presidential nomination is now smaller. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina dropped out of the race on Monday, acknowledging that he was winning little political support. Well, his departure cuts the field of Republican contenders to 13. Graham is a longtime advocate for a robust American military presence overseas. My colleague Ray Kugel spoke with VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone about what Graham's decision to quit the race could mean.
Well, Lindsey Graham was not drawing much support in public opinion polls. In fact, he was drawing so little that he never even made the main debate stage and was relegated to these so-called undercard debates, where he did very well. He presented himself with humor, with conviction, and he was really the preeminent national security hawk in the Republican field. He openly advocated to send large numbers of U.S. troops back into Iraq and also into Syria to try to settle the civil war there and take care of Islamic State. So Graham's departure will kind of take that hawkish voice out of the field, but the practical impact, I don't see much there. He simply was not drawing much support in the polls.
The hawkish positions he held are being expressed by many of the other candidates. Can they pick up from this or anything from him?
Some of them would like to. Lindsey Graham may have a voice when the race turns to the South Carolina primary later in February. Usually that's an important race in the Republican field. And a number of contenders already are expressing the hope they might get his endorsement when it comes to South Carolina voters. I think one in particular who's looking for that might be Florida Senator Marco Rubio. He's worked with Graham in the Senate, but also he's trying to position himself as one of the preeminent foreign policy experts in the Republican field, arguing for a tougher stance against Islamic State. The need for some U.S. ground forces, though primarily he would advocate a coalition of ground forces from Muslim nations, and of course an intensified air campaign. So Rubio is probably the one now hoping to pick up whatever support Graham may have had.
Why do you think some of these lesser candidates continue?
Good question. I think there's still a feeling in many of the campaigns that there's so much uncertainty about where things are headed as we look at 2016. The race is really just starting. We've had a lot of polls. We see how well Donald Trump is doing. But we also see the rise and somewhat the fall of someone like Ben Carson. So I think for a lot of these campaigns, there are lessons there. They believe if they hang in long enough to see how it starts to sort itself out when the voting begins, you know, they might have a chance. That's why someone like Jeb Bush is perhaps hanging in there. Ohio Governor John Kasich. Certainly New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who's seen his polling numbers go up in the early state of New Hampshire of late. So in some ways, even though a lot of these folks may not seem to have much of a chance, they don't see a reason to get out because many of them aren't convinced that in the end, Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Thank you, Ray.
And Jim Malin was speaking to International Edition's Ray Kugel. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Stanford University School of Medicine scientists have found that mice who had suffered strokes recovered much faster if they were given low doses of a popular drug that helps treat insomnia. A stroke occurs when the brain's blood supply gets disrupted. According to the researchers, initial brain damage caused by a stroke usually takes place within a couple of hours after the blood flow is interrupted and then continues to spread until the brain starts to rewire itself. So far, there are no known drug therapies that can help patients with their recovery once a stroke has occurred. The researchers induced strokes in mice and then gave them low doses of Zolpidem, also known as Ambien. They found the drug helped enhance a type of brain cell signaling activity, which dramatically improved the mice's rate of recovery from a stroke. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. Academy Award winner and Golden Globe winner Jennifer Lawrence has a new movie role as a woman who made her fortune by designing household products. International Edition's David Byrd tells us that Lawrence teamed up with actor Bradley Cooper and director David O. Russell for the film Joy.
Christy, look at me. I want you to remember something, because a lot of times people get nice things and they start to think differently. We got here from hard work, patience, and humility. So I want to tell you, don't ever think that the world owes you anything, because it doesn't. The world doesn't owe you a thing.
Jennifer Lawrence reunited with director David O. Russell and Bradley Cooper, her co-star in Silver Linings Playbook and American Hustle, to tell the story of Joy Mangano, a Long Island-born housewife who found fame and fortune by designing household products. Mangano, a divorced mother of three, developed the so-called Miracle Mop, and in 1992 pitched it to the QVC television shopping network. It became an overnight success.
Hi, I'm Joy Mangano, and I invented the Miracle Mop. It's the original cotton self-wringing mop, therefore the most absorbent. It will clean that mess again and again and again. And
I'm Jennifer Lawrence says that she was inspired by Mangano's story and wanted to bring it to the screen.
There's so many impressive parts of her that she... And just about the story in general, about how kind of long it took her to finally decide, I'm not going to let this dream go. I'm going to keep fighting for this, no matter who believes in me, no matter who doesn't, no matter how many people say no.
You got the exact same outfit you had when you came in here.
I wear a blouse and I wear pants. That's who I am. I want to go on as me.
I want to go on as you. I hope you make it back. Joan, Cindy. Say good luck to Joy.
Wow. You look great. Good luck today.
Oh, thank you.
Good luck.
That's her. That's how she is.
Blossom, she should be in a skirt. She's got nice long legs. Show her legs. Good luck.
Joan Rivers wants me in a skirt, but I'm going to do pants.
Bradley Cooper says he actually met Joy Mangano, and he knew he wanted to make this film.
I was in the middle of doing a play, so then I knew that the real Joy was at the hotel I was staying at, so I went down and met her. So that's all I knew, was based on a real thing. But I also was very aware of the Miracle Mop. I grew up using that mop because QVC was also a huge part of my upbringing.
Director David O. Russell, an Oscar nominee for his last two films with Lawrence and Cooper, says familiarity with his actors makes for a comfortable set where more chances are taken.
You have a comfort level with each other that just means you can take new chances. Jennifer is more quietly powerful in this film than I've seen her. She's not loud. She's doing something different that I find very interesting. Bradley as well. You know, they both watched them grow up in the last 5 years.
Jennifer Lawrence, who has been nominated for a Golden Globe for her performance in Joy, says that Russell makes it easy to take chances in front of the camera.
And it's so wonderful working with David, where I don't have to think about anything. If he gives me a note and it sounds absolutely insane, I just do it. It's a trust fall, and it's wonderful.
Joy also stars Oscar winner Robert De Niro as Joy Mangano's father, Rudy. Melissa Rivers stars as her mother, comedian and QVC host Joan Rivers, and actors Donna Mills and Susan Lucci portray themselves. The film opens December 25th in the United States. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. You can find us at voanews.com by clicking on the Programs tab at the top of the page, then scrolling down and clicking on the link to the International Edition program page. Your director today was Patrice Martin, and the engineer was Al Santos. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. If you want to reach me on Twitter, send me a tweet at Michael_Lippin. This show also lives on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. We'll see you next time.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The El Niño phenomenon has significantly impacted weather patterns in Ethiopia this year, limiting agricultural production, straining livelihoods, and exacerbating food insecurity among vulnerable households. As El Niño continues into 2016, Ethiopia is likely to experience both prolonged drought and intense flooding that will further deteriorate conditions. The projected levels of need for relief food assistance in Ethiopia have grown from 2.9 million people in early 2015 to 10.2 million people as of December 11th. Approximately 5.8 million people will need clean water. To address this humanitarian crisis, the United States announced an additional $88 million in humanitarian assistance to increase funding for nutrition, food, water, sanitation, and hygiene support. With this new assistance, USAID will scale up rapid response systems for nutrition and water and support partners to jumpstart pipelines of relief supplies. This follows the release of the humanitarian requirements document on December 11th, to which the United States immediately responded and released approximately 116,460 metric tons of food assistance. USAID is currently supporting approximately 3.9 million Ethiopians and refugees with relief food assistance. Additionally, USAID provides approximately $100 million annually in support of the Productive Safety Net program, which the government of Ethiopia has expanded to reach nearly 8 million of the most chronically food insecure. Through the provision of regular food and cash transfers, households can protect critical assets such as livestock during these times of crisis. Ethiopia is now better able to cope with such crises due to improved tracking of the progression of El Niño and its impact, the establishment of the Productive Safety Net program, and serious engagement by the government of Ethiopia to analyze and respond to the ongoing crisis exacerbated by El Niño. USAID's resilience investments, including efforts to safeguard livelihood assets and better manage natural resources, are also helping the most vulnerable Ethiopian households cope with the impacts of El Niño. Nevertheless, these are the driest conditions ever recorded in parts of Ethiopia, and there is an urgent need for all donors to step up and do what they can. The United States will continue to work with the government of Ethiopia and its international partners to provide humanitarian relief and adapt development efforts to help meet the immediate needs of those most impacted by El Nino, help mitigate the impact of the drought, and speed recovery.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.